As Bart mentioned, I'm going to do this talk on an architectural style called event-driven architecture and how it solves some problems that you might encounter when you're working on a system like Azure. Bart already introduced me a little bit. I'm involved in the Azure as a board member. I'm also a solution architect for Capgemini Belgium. But I'm also very reachable online, so I've included some contact details in case you have any questions after the talk or after today and you wish to contact me. You can find me on one of these addresses. Okay. Now, what are we going to discuss in this talk? At first, I'm going to give you, again, a short overview of the benefits that you have from a cloud environment. Just as David Chappell did in his first talk. It's only one slide, right? But it's not only benefits. And the cloud, in general, because it's such a big system and because it's global, does has some unique design challenges that you need to deal with in order to make your application suitable for the cloud. And the problem is that these challenges will have some impact on the traditional service-oriented architecture that you use today, in this talk, then, I will try to address the challenges by presenting another architectural style called event-driven architecture. I will go through this one in theory first, so I will talk about how is an event-driven architecture structured, how does event processing occur, and also because it is and certain architecture, it also has its disadvantages. And one of the disadvantages, or most of them, are related to the fact that we are distributed and we have a gigantic system effect. And how this is dealt with in an event-driven architecture. So that's the third part. Then finally, I will conclude with how the theory of an EDA maps to the challenges posed by the cloud. And I will also give you a demo. Right. I have a demo set up here that shows you how an event-driven architecture works. And I will also give you the technology mapping from the Azure or other Microsoft products that you can use together to realize it. So cloud computing is, as David Chappell mentioned earlier, is actually a very, very attractive model. It gives us an illusion, at least, of infinite storage, infinite compute power, infinite resources. And we can get them whenever we want. We can get how many we want. It gives us extreme flexibility in upsizing, downsizing, as we can get resources by the hour or by the day or by the month. Right? It's extremely flexible. We do not have to invest to use it. We can just sign up an account online, grab a credit card, and we can get started. We have no real upfront investments to do. If used correctly, it can also lead to severely reduced costs. I think Kurt talked about the usage patterns, for example, the on-off scenario. If you can turn your application off for X days, you save the cost of those days. Right? So when used correctly, you can reduce your overall costs. And furthermore, it's also better for the environment. At least that's what all the vendors claim. Consolidating all of the resources in this world into only a limited number of data sets should reduce energy usage and carbon emission. Right? But so it's a lot of advantages that we can get from cloud computing, but there are also some downsides. There are some design challenges that you need to be aware of and that you need to calculate into your architecture. Those downsides are both related to the size. One of the main issues in a cloud environment is that all large-scale systems, and I mean thousands of machines, will suffer from some form of latency. Right? Some machines that are reading data will read different data than others. I will explain to you in a minute how that comes. On the other hand, none of the cloud providers give you any support for distributed transactions. So if today you're using the DTC or any other form of distributed transaction, that's a no-no. You can't use it. I will explain you why. Global systems also deliver absolutely no guarantee for instance availability. I do not mean service availability. So they will all guarantee you that your service will be running, but they will not guarantee you that at any given moment in time a particular instance will be running. So if you rely on that fact, your architecture will be broken. Okay? Now, what's the cause of this? Well, data latency is caused just by the way that the fabric is actually working. I've heard it a few times in the previous talks today, but data in a fabric is actually backed up automatically by replicating it in at least three machines, probably more, right? This replication is automatically, you will get it always, and this data replication, depending on the traffic at that moment or depending on the size of the data that needs to be replicated, will cause latency, right? This is further enhanced by the fact that there is a concept called failure and upgrade domains inside the fabric. And that means that different data is never replicated to machines that are close to each other. They will also always be replicated to a machine in a different rack in a data center or even in another data center. So machines that act as peers in the replication process will never be located close to each other. So the latency is noticeable, right? The distributed transaction factor that isn't available in the cloud has to do with the very nature of the two-phase commit protocol that is sitting behind the DTC or the distributed transaction. In this protocol, every participant, every machine involved in a transaction actually needs to confirm the transaction twice. Okay? It first has to say, I'm done. And secondly, it has to accept the fact that the others are done. That's in short, the protocol. Now, if you add more and more and more and more machines, the number of participants in the communication grows exponentially. So this drastically limits the scalability of the entire process of two-phase commit. If you have 1,000 machines that need to communicate to every single other that the commit is done, it will take a long, long, long time. And that's why none of the cloud vendors will support distributed transactions, not even for small applications. Okay? It's just not there. The instance availability problem is because that Azure or any other vendor is actually a global system. And global means that it's available for anyone, any place, any time of day. The people or the automated processes in this case that are actually doing upgrade and maintenance procedures do not have a window in which they can safely take down instances. To counteract that, they have just simply decided that we take it down anyway, whenever you want. Okay? At any point in time during your business day, a single instance can be taken down just for doing patches, doing upgrades, and stuff. Now, there is some kind of countermeasure in place that will guarantee you that if you have of a single role at least two instances, that they will not be taken down together. It's one of them, the other one will continue to work, they guarantee that. They will spin up a new one. But if you only have one instance, that specific instance can be taken down at any point in time. Okay? So you have to take that into account. Now, a traditional service-oriented or a traditional composite service-oriented architecture where you use regular request-reply communication like you do with web services, right? Actually considers all of these, or it assumes that all of these three things are available. If a service does a query on a data store or database, it will always assume that the data it retrieves is accurate. Almost always. Anybody who has other experiences that you create specific programming logic because you think your database is incorrect? Anybody? No. That's an assumption. It also assumes distributed transactions. very often with the WSTOR specs or directly with the DTC, but all of us are using them. Whenever a certain operation, a certain piece of work involves multiple services, we assume that if anything goes wrong, there is a nice rollback system that will safely undo all of the work. And thirdly, because we're doing direct communication, because we do request-reply communication, the caller of a service will assume that the service itself will stay available during the call. So all of these three assumptions are valid for a traditional composite service-oriented architecture. So a traditional SOA is not so suitable for the cloud, so we need to look at different or other architectural patterns that may be suitable in the cloud for your particular purpose. Right? And one of them, in my opinion, is an event-driven architecture. And in an event-driven architecture, everything involves around an event. Now, an event can be defined as something notable, something interesting that happens in the business. That's important. An event is related to the business in which the for which the architecture is operating. That might mean a state change, like, for example, a temperature in an whatever oven is changing. Or that might be an opportunity on the market, right? Certain stock that drops below something, I don't know. It might also mean a certain threshold or deviation. For example, nothing happened, right? The absence of something that happens can be an event as well. So an event is something that interests you. Now, from a technical perspective, an event is nothing more than a message with the content that actually happened in the past, like this happened. Important to note, and this is something that everybody forgets, events are completely self-describing. All of the important information related to the business, right, is encapsulated inside of the message. So events might actually be kind of bulky in size of data. The interesting point here is something interesting to you is different than interesting for me, even inside the same organization. Right? Somebody or something has to be able to determine what is interesting. And I'll come back to that later, but it's something that you need to keep in mind. You do not want to monitor every single event in the organization or in the cloud. Right? It's a lot. You just want to get those that are interesting. Now, by talking in the past and by encapsulating everything inside of a message and treating it as something that has happened, allows you to add an additional or to actually invert the communication between different services or different event generators and event consumers. And because everything is encapsulated inside of the message, it allows you to actually postpone the treatment of that message in time. So this is an additional loose coupling effect that you get. The origin of an event and the processing of the event can be separated in time and will be separated in time. And this, the fact that you can do this, allows you to overcome most of the problems with regard to instance availability. If the instance goes down, okay, it will pick it up later. Right? So that's an important piece. The main goal of all the event generators is actually to capture as many events as possible and then send them together on one single event stream. So you gather as much information as you can. It's the thing that decides what is interesting that will later filter out whatever it needs to pass on to the event generators. Okay? So that's different. You do not just simply create events for everything that you find interesting today. You try to capture as much information as you can. All right. Let's take a step further and look at the structure of a typical event-driven architecture. In an event-driven architecture, we can distinguish four different event flow layers. On the one hand, we have the thing I already mentioned, is an event generator. An event generator should not be considered as the actual physical thing that raises events, but it should be considered as a piece of software that transforms the events in reality into something that can be interpreted by a system, usually a message. Okay? So it's the responsibility of the event generator to form the interface between what is happening in reality and the digital world. Now, the event generator will typically transform this event into some kind of message and then push it actively into the event channel. The event channel is a transport mechanism that can transport the messages throughout the system, right? Throughout the entire architecture. This doesn't mean that there's only one channel. Usually this is a combination of different technologies and mostly queue-like stuff. But logically, it's only one stream. It's one stream of events that anybody can look into. Now, in order to determine from that stream of what is actually interesting, we have something named an event processing engine. An event processing engine can be split into two distinct parts. One, to determine what is interesting. That's called the event processing engine, which has standing queries inside of it. A standing query, you know what a regular query is. If you have a database, you have data sitting there. You want to have some information from it, so you craft a query and you throw it at the data. A standing query is the exact opposite. First, you create a query, you put it there, and then you throw data at it. That is the exact opposite of a database. You have a persistent query that is constantly running, and you throw data through it. Depending if the query says, yes, this kind of data matches or does not match, you will choose an appropriate action. The actions might include, this is a limited list, but might include, for example, publishing it to a number of subscribers, so a PubSub system. It might also choose an action to notify a single person or single service. It might also invoke the service manually, so it might just transform a message into a regular service call. It might also choose to start a business process using a workflow or something. And very importantly, it might decide to capture it, to store it on disk or in a database. Right? Capturing events is very important because if you consider capturing all events, you still have them in place in case that you need to extend your architecture in the future. And you can grab events from that one to recreate what would have happened if the service were available a year ago. Okay? So that's one you definitely need to consider. An event processing engine might definitely decide to invoke multiple actions. So it's perfectly possible to both send something to the audit queue or the capture, right? It might also invoke a web service, and it might also send it to a PubSub system, right? You can choose. Right. Now, I missed the last layer. Of course, there is also something that happens whenever the event has been deemed interesting, and that's what we call a downstream activity, or sometimes also an event consumer. Now, there are two types of downstream activities. One is, it's a push activity. That means that the event processing engine will actively push the event through to the downstream activity. Or it is a pull one. That means that the event processing engine will expose the events in some way, like, for example, a queue, or like RSS, or some way. And the downstream activity is itself monitoring the list of interesting events. Right? So you have two choices there. Right. Now, how do you determine if something is interesting? In order to do that, there are, in general, three different event processing styles. You can combine them, no issue, but these are the three event processing styles that you see commonly. And the first one is exactly the same image as the previous image. And that's simply simple event processing, which means that the event processing engine is responsible of doing two things. First, identification of the event, so identify whether it's interesting. And secondly, event forwarding. It needs to ensure that the event gets to the downstream activities that are interested in the event. Right? That simple event processing is also pretty simple to implement. Now, a more advanced style is stream event processing. In this scenario, multiple event generators all generate some type of event, for example, the temperature or some pressure or something, and they all push it into the event channel, in which you get a long list of events. The event processing engine will then typically monitor a window of time in which the events occur. Right? This window of time might be 1 hour or might be 1 day, and it's up to you. Right? Then it will apply some correlation logic to either detect, for example, the number of occurrences of a given event or deviations between different events, etc. So it will monitor the content of the window, and it will take some kind of intelligent decision based on what it sees in the window. And it's that occurrence that it will actually forward to one or more of the downstream activities. This is a bit more difficult to implement manually. Luckily, there are some products that can help you with this. I'll show you one later. And then the third one is called complex event processing. And this is, as the name says, the most complex one. The idea here is that the event processing engine will look for events in the event channel, either of events of the same type or events of very different types, of events that occur at very different points in time. And it will try to apply some kind of complex processing logic to it, potentially storing previous events in a local database to correlate those events with whatever it's seeing today. So with this, you can correlate occurrences of something with occurrences of something else. Like, I'm thinking of all of those plane crash TV shows, right? If you look at those TV shows, a plane always crashes because 1, 2, 3, or 5 events occurred in a longer period of time. With this kind of event processing style, you can actually detect the correlation between these different events. Right? And if all of these events occur, or if the correct combination of events occur, then the event processing engine will create a new event and send that event to the downstream activity. So those are the three distinct processing styles. You can combine them. So it's perfectly possible to do complex event processing on a single window of time, or generate an event that in itself will invoke a simple process. Any questions on this? Is this something you can correlate back to something in your business? Like, this is logic that could be simple event, most of it, by the way. This is logic that could be done with a stream event or with stream monitoring of certain events, and others are complex. Right. Now, this in itself, the fact that we capture the event in a message, that we can postpone the event in time, gives us many benefits, but it also gives us some side effects. Right? It's not that easy to work in this way. Now, the kinds of loose coupling that the event-driven architecture delivers to you is, first of all, implementation loose coupling. The event generator and the event consumer have absolutely even no idea of each other's existence. So they also do not depend on each other's implementation. So by definition, this is true. But this is only realizable if all the information is encapsulated inside of the event. If you don't do this, and some people don't, right, then you will only collect identifiers, for example, inside of the event message, but then you bind them back together, because at a certain point in time, the event consumer will have to look at what information belongs to the identifier and will bind itself back to the implementation of the generator. So that's actually a no-no. Right? It's also, by default, distributable. The event generator and the event consumer, they can physically be separated from each other, and usually they will, as long as they can access the same event channel. So that's the only requirement. That doesn't even have to be the same event channel. You could perfectly federate channels. But as long as they have one way of communicating the event to one another through the event stream, it's OK. This is always the case in the cloud. All of your different roles are always separate virtual machines, and they are actually distributed, from your perspective anyway. Okay, the third kind of decoupling is decoupling in time, right? I've already explained this one. And fourthly, it also allows a decoupling in evolution. What do I mean with that? The way that events are generated, or the way that events are consumed, can change independently of one another. So if today you use metric system A to determine event, and tomorrow your hardware upgrades, then you get metric system B. But whenever the event generator outputs the same information, the same event structure, all of the other stuff will continue to work. In a well-designed EDA, it's also the case that consumers or downstream activities will never be changed. You will consistently add new features. So if today, for example, I have a system that allows me to post blocks, something stupid, then I can just simply have one event consumer that detects the blog posted event and stores it in a database. Right? If I want tomorrow to add some kind of anti-spam feature, I can just simply add an additional event consumer, which will do the spam detection. Right? So think incrementally. This will drastically improve the change management process of your architecture. You never change something existing. You build something additional. If you want to really change something, you first build something additional, and then you delete the first one. Right? Think in those terms. It's really easy with an EDA. Okay. Now, an EDA has those four kinds of loose coupling, but there is also a rule called Brewer's Cap Theorem, from year 2000, I think, which states that a distributed system, or a loosely coupled system, can only satisfy any two of the CAP guarantees. So the C stands for consistency, which actually means all nodes in the system see the same data at the same time. Now, this one is the one we're going to skip. Right, because Azure, as a global system, cannot provide this anyway. So we are going to sacrifice consistency. On the other hand, we also have availability. Whenever any of the nodes fails, the entire system should continue to operate at least partially, but usually completely. And then we also have partition tolerance. And partition tolerance means that if some parts of the system get actually partitioned or isolated from one another by, for example, loss of network connectivity, that the system also continues to operate. Right? That the different pieces of the system continue to operate on their own, and that they will catch up the integration later. So if you create a distributed system or a loosely coupled system, you can only satisfy two of these three, and you have to pick your battles. Right? In an EDA, we typically sacrifice consistency. And this matches well with how the cloud works. We do not have distributed transactions. Distributed transactions are normally used to give us a consistent view of the data that we're working on. We don't have that. So quite a good match. The two others, instance availability matches to the availability of the CAP. Right? Network is also out of our control. It's perfectly possible that one data center is turned off. Right? Something stupid. But the system should continue to operate. It's not in our hands. So EDA, the fact that it sacrifices consistency over the two others, will make it a very good match for cloud computing. Now, it doesn't sacrifice consistency completely. It will try to replace it with a concept called eventually consistent, or a base system. If a transactional system is called an asset system, you probably know that acronym, then this kind of system is called a base system, a basically available and something else system. Right? It means normally it operates. Sometimes it doesn't. Now, how does it try to deal with this fact that it has to eventually become consistent, even in the case of catastrophes? Right? It will use a technique called compensation, and in terms of an EDA, compensating events. It will treat business errors or technical exceptions as events. It will capture them. It will push them into the event stream, and then it will just continue processing, hoping that somebody else downstream will actually fix things. Okay? That's the basic idea. Now, downstream, there is normally an event consumer, which can be a machine or a human, that will monitor the events and invoke a compensating action. So it's not an undo action, but it's a make things right again action. Right? It will try to fix the problem with the means that it has. And this can be a human. Eh? So don't think that for every single exception you will have to create a separate event consumer. No, it's perfectly possible to say this kind of exception or error will not occur frequently, so we'll hand it over to the development team. Perfectly possible. Okay. In order to achieve eventual consistency, we do have to assure that whenever one of these compensating transactions or compensating event consumers is operating, that during the operation, if anything goes wrong, that the operation will be retried later. It's a local transaction. Local transactions are required in order to make this work. Well, local transactions are supported in, at least inside Azure. All of the different queue mechanics, either in the .NET service bus or in the storage, all support a concept called queue peak lock. It's not really a transaction. What it does is that whenever somebody takes a message from the queue, the message becomes actually not deleted from the queue, but it becomes invisible. If the consumer does not achieve to delete the message in time, which usually means if everything's programmed correctly that they blew up, right? Then the message will reappear. And a next one or another one will pick up the message again and process it. So it's this queue peak lock mechanism that's implemented in all of the different queuing mechanisms will ensure that even if a single role goes down during the processing of a compensating transaction, that it will be retried later. Now, this does also imply that the event consumer can operate on its own. Right? If it has any other dependencies on data outside, except for stuff in the fabric, right? You can use the fabric, then it cannot guarantee this. It cannot guarantee that the next time it processes it, that it will actually work. Right? Now, inside an EDA, the concept of the service, the SOA principle, service autonomy, has to be implemented completely. This is different than from a traditional SOA. In a traditional SOA, you can definitely have one service call the other one and then call the other one. You will get away with that. In an EDA, you don't. Now, how can you achieve this? This kind of service autonomy, where a service is completely self-reliant. Now, you do this by means of state machines. You probably know what a state machine is. If you don't, it's like a block comment, for example, that has three states. It is pending, it is accepted, or it is rejected. And depending on the operation call, it will change its internal state. That's a state machine. If you create every single event consumer as a state machine, everyone, yeah, then you can use the state machine in order to allow it to implement risk mitigation logic. Now, risk mitigation logic means that if I'm in a certain state and I notice a certain event, then I can either do something or don't. This allows you to have, we'll come back to that, there's another one. But internally, it uses its own local state, either cached in memory or in the fabric. And local, I can also consider the fabric. But it has to apply the risk mitigation logic on top of that in order to allow a certain transition or not. There is some kind of boundary that you can play with. And either this is for a state transition relationship event, this is something that I can definitely do not, right? Like, for example, imagine that our local gas system is heavily under pressure last time that we checked, and now there is another event for more pressure, then we can definitely say, no. Okay? We know, based on the local state, which may be old, right? We can definitely check the boundaries in which a certain state transition will be either okay or not okay. Right? There are some boundaries. Now, services do not operate on their own. They have relationships with others. And sometimes this risk mitigation logic depends on the state of another service. Right? Sometimes a certain object or a certain group of objects has to consider the state of its partners in order to take a certain decision. For example, is our business partner, is he creditworthy? Right? Does he have enough money? This is something that we need to capture. We need to know the fact if our partner is creditworthy, but still we cannot take a direct relationship with that partner service. So we have to capture the state, the last known state of our partners locally. We have to duplicate some data from partner services locally in our local store, in the fabric, or either in memory. And we have to use that in our state transition logic. This is usually done by just simply listening to other events and capturing those events as well. Right? You capture the interesting events from your partners and you store the data locally. Now, based on the last known state, which is stale by definition, because this is something in the cloud, and it also allows for out-of-order events. The fact that certain events arrive way too late might cause them to no longer have any impact on the state transitions internally. So because they get out of order, the internal logic, if you implement it correctly, of course, can deal with this. So, right. Eventually, consistency does not only impose some challenges to the implementation of service, it also poses challenges to the user. In some way, we have to let the user know that the system is actually working on it. We can never tell the user that we're finished until it's actually finished. Right? There is a potential that the time between event occurrence and event processing becomes long, because there is the stream in between which allows us to postpone work in time. So we can't make the promises to the user that we are finished or that we will be finished in, like, say, 10 minutes. No. We'll just have to tell the user, like, we've got your message, right? It will probably be okay in the next second, but maybe it's a little bit later. If you go online, a lot of applications do this. If you go to a forum, very often you enter some text and you will not be immediately see the result of your text. You will usually get a message like, okay, we got your message. Then you go back to the forum, hit F5 a few times, and then usually it is there. Basically, it's available, but sometimes it isn't. This is easier to do in what Microsoft calls an inductive user interface, or what I call a task-oriented user interface. If your user interface is created alongside the task that the user is actually executing, it's easier to say in the end, well, I got your message, I know what you want to do, I'll get back to you later. If you just simply made a CRUD-like API interface with grids and stuff, it's more difficult. Right? You could tell them, well, the save hasn't been done. Bit strange. Okay. Now, all of these things together, they address the challenges that are proposed by cloud environment. It has some challenges of its own, agree, but it does address all of the three issues that we have had or that we will have inside a large-scale system. Now the latency, the data latency, this one is solved by capturing all of the relevant information inside of the event so that the event consumer does not have to go to the doesn't necessarily have to go to the data store, to the fabric, to get the latest information. It's in there. That's the information at that point in time. Now, because we also have this kind of risk mitigation logic internally that combines the information inside of the event with the potentially stale information in the data store or in a local cache, it combines those two, and it will come to an acceptable result. Right? So that's what allows us to deal with the latency between data replication in the fabric, because it's natively built in into the logic of a typical EDA. Now for availability, if we use a durable mechanism or semi-durable mechanism for our event channel, we will also achieve availability at this level. A node can perfectly go down. If it comes back up, it will read the channel again, or its private queue, for example, and it will continue working. Because all of the information is encapsulated in there, it hasn't missed anything, it can just continue. So it will come back up. Furthermore, the fact that you can have this this stream event processing technique where you can look at windows, you can use this to improve the availability of your system. You can look at certain events, and if they stay absent for a certain amount of time, you can react to this. The event processing engine sees no event for a certain amount of time, so it raises another event, which will result in a self-healing action that will either bring up the nodes again or notify an administrator that he can look at it manually. Okay, so this is something that you can build because you have the event processing engine. The fact that we do not have any distributed transactions is being solved by the mechanism of compensation. So exceptions and errors will be turned into events and thrown on the event stream and processed by a compensating transaction, which can be either man or machine. Okay. Just a drink. Now, how does this map to technology? In Azure, there is actually quite a lot that allows you to implement an EDA, except for a few things, which used to be there, but they're no longer. As an event channel, we can take either the table storage queues, or we can take one of or two features from the App Fabric, the service bus, the .NET service bus. One is message buffers, which Kurt described earlier. And the other one is the WCF relay bindings, which are also described by Kurt, but he only described the service bus side. But there is also a WCF binding that allows you to communicate with those things. So that's why I call it WCF relay bindings. They all have benefits and they all have downsides. The table storage, this is the one I will use also in my demo, has the advantage of being really, really, really durable. Okay? It's replicated across three machines. It, theoretically, you could lose the data, the message. Probably not. Right? It's really durable, and they stay alive forever. So queues might, well, become unused, fill up, whatever. They contain data, you will pay for them. So some kind of queue management, manual or automatic, it's up to you, will be need to put into place in order to clean up the dead queues. This is especially true if your application has sized up and then needs to be sized down again. Because if you size it down, the application, you can't just simply immediately delete the queue. Because you don't know if the machine actually just simply got killed and should restart a bit later, or that you're downsizing. Unless you program it in, okay, you can do that. So it's perfectly possible that some queues will remain dead. They will not do anything. It supports queue peak lock. This is similar to local transactions, and it can be used in that way. So for me, this is a very, very suitable technology. The .NET services versus message buffers are also a very interesting technology in the fact that they have some kind of durability. They are not durable forever. Whenever you create a message buffer in the service bus, you will have to specify for how long it may exist after the last activity. So you could say, if there is no activity for 15 minutes, die. Okay, this allows you to avoid the management of the queues. But if a system goes down too long, you might lose messages that way. Okay, so it's a bit of give or take. It also supports the queue peak lock mechanism. So in that, it's similar to the other one. The WCF relay bindings, they do not support any kind of transactions today. Might mistake, but they don't. So not even local transactions, which is for me the biggest downside. But they have the upside that they can cross the firewalls. They can cross network address translation. So if you're in a situation with, for example, a cloud server and a mobile device running around the country, and occasionally it sits behind a firewall, then that might be a good solution. But you sacrifice the ability to do a local transaction. So you have to take that into account. Okay. For event processing engine, there are two pieces to such an engine. First of all, there is the technology that determines whether or not some kind of event is interesting. And this does not exist today in the cloud. It does exist as a Microsoft product. It has been released 2 weeks ago. It's called Microsoft Stream Insight. And to my regret, it's hidden inside of SQL Server. Because the name query is in there, it's inside a SQL Server, I think. But in fact, it's the exact opposite of a database. A database means local data, throw queries at it. Stream Insight means position a query, throw data at it. It's the exact opposite. It allows you to do stream event processing. It's really good at it. It also allows you to do complex event processing. For event forwarding, there used to be a feature inside of the .NET service bus which were called routers. A router was just simply something in the bus which you could create. And you could tell it either publish the information to all of the attached listeners or to one of them. So it gave me PubSub and gave me some kind of load balancing. This one was particularly interesting because you could configure it to hook up to a message buffer automatically. You could just simply say, you router, listen to that buffer. And the other way around as well. So you could have a queue, and which is a message buffer, and a PubSub system, or a distribution system, and you could hook them up without having to write a single line of code. It was just simply sending messages to the service bus, and it would configure it for you. So that's really interesting. And I talked to the team, and they told me that it will probably come back. They don't know when, but it will come back. So that's why I included it in the slide. It's not that technology. It will come back, and it's a very, very interesting way to do either the publish action or the notify action. Now, today you can't. Today it doesn't exist. So I looked at other frameworks on the market or in the open source space, and I came up with nServiceBus. And ServiceBus is actually nothing more than a set of libraries. It's a set of libraries written just simple .NET, so it's just a simple .NET library, which also allows you to do some routing capabilities. So you could either create a publisher, which is the distributed to all, right? Or you could create a distributor, which means choose one of the following, the any. It has also some support for simple event processing at least, because it allows you to hook up message handlers to a transport, which could be an event channel. And it also gives you some kind of complex event processing technique, which is called Saga Patron. I'm not going to dive into this. If you want to catch up, Google. There's a long, big PDF that you can read on this pattern. But it allows you to do it in case you couldn't do it with Stream Insight. Just an option. Okay. So those are the techniques. I would like to show you a demo of this thing. But before I can show you, because the demo is actually really, really easy, it just does something. I would like to show you how I set up all of the different components in order to achieve the result that I wanted to get. Now, on top, you see a number of web roles. I've drawn 5, right, I know. In my real demo, because of my slowly performing machine, it's only 2. But it's infinite, theoretically, right? Each web role will typically act as an event generator. It will capture user gestures, whatever the user does in the browser is being transmitted to the web role, and it transforms it into a message and pushes the message on the event stream queue. If this thing has a pointer here. This is the event stream queue. So every single message or every single event will pass through the event stream queue. Other important knowledge about the web role is that for querying purposes, it will just simply query its in-memory store. It will cache all of the information that it knows in memory for performance reasons. Right? That's the fastest that I could come up with, so I do it in memory. This is perfectly possible in EDA because you can simply subscribe your web role to any interesting events that it wants to know, so that it can clean up or replace the cached information. In case the cached information is not available, it will use table storage to retrieve it. So that's the alternative. Not that the performance is really bad of table storage, but in-memory is faster. Now, whenever an event is generated in the web role, it will be processed through the complex event processing engine, in this case being Stream Insight. Stream Insight can be used not only as a service, but it can be used standalone as a library. You just add a reference and you start using it. So I've created a worker role. I've embedded Stream Insight library inside of it, created some queries to identify what is interesting to me, and those queries will output the information into either or all three of these queues. These queues are one, a publisher, which allows me to distribute the event to all of the subscribers. This is really interesting to update the cache of all of the different web roles so that they have the latest information, at least when the message arrives. It also forwards the message to a queue for the distributor, and the distributor will choose any of my available worker roles. The distributor is a little bit more intelligent than just choosing one of them. It has a list of which ones are currently processing and which one doesn't. So it will have some kind of routing logic which allows it to choose an available worker. The worker will do something. Could be validation, could be storage, depends on the event that it gets. And typically, this one will act then as another event generator, creating an event that it either accepted the blog post or that it stored whatever, that it persisted something. It will tell it, right? All the information, I try to capture as much information inside of this event stream, and then I filter out. That's the general mantra. For example, imagine that a blog post was persisted. This one will be, as an event, pushed again through Stream Insight. It will end up at either one of these and potentially update the cache of a web role. This is the architecture. This architecture allows either of these roles to go down, either of those to go down. Oh, sorry. The publisher, the distributor, and even the CEP engine can be duplicated. So either one of them can go down, no issue. So all of the different parts of the system can be duplicated, can be scaled out, and they are resilient to the network failure, they are resilient to instance failure, they have local transactions to do retry. So all of the issues that you might have inside a large environment, this is not only true for the cloud, can be dealt with. Okay, so that's the setup. Now let me show you. Where is the... Oh, this one first. So this is the Dev Fabric. The Dev Fabric is actually Azure on your local machine, right? It's not as performant as Azure, but that's logically. I'm hosting at this point in time 6 or 7 virtual machines, 2 web hosts, 2 worker hosts, so the worker hosts do the actual processing. I have 1 host for the distributor, 1 for the event processing engine, and 1 for the publisher. I could scale them out as far as the capacity of my machine could take me. All right. Now, what does the end user see? The end user sees a website, which was a lot more room earlier. I'll try to get it okay. But this website is actually representing a content management system. Thanks to JavaScript, I can do some drag-and-droppy thingies here, create new pages, add some content. And all of this is being recorded by JavaScript, and in the backend, it's being sent back to the web role. Right? So if I do something, I will, for example, add a page. Right? I can say add. I will add a demo page. Hope you can read this. And I will do submit. Now, this is interesting. After the submit, I have sent to the web role that something happened, that I added a page. But now I need to tell the user, well, the item or the page, should this have been, has been added. It may take a few seconds or even minutes before it actually appears. Now, I do fake this out because if you look at the top, I've used JavaScript and I assume that it will eventually be there. So I will just simply put the text there. But it's only for this user. Other users navigating the site do not necessarily have to see this link at this point in time. It's not important. As long as this one sees it, and the other ones will eventually get it. Okay. Now, I can do a refresh, but because so much time has gone by. I do the refresh because I have multiple web roles. So thanks to the load balancer, I will get the other one. Okay? But because so much time has gone through by my talking, the other web role has already been updated. So, okay, I will go to this page. Now I will, for example, drag some content on it. Voila. I will do the same trick again. I will show a form. And again, after the submit, I will notify the user that something happened. I will act as if this is true. And maybe if I'm lucky, it's so slow that I can get a... No, it's not that slow. The message goes through the EDA. There are cases when the event takes some time before it actually gets completely processed. So it is possible that at a certain point in time you press F5, for example, and that the text disappears again. But that's why we have the apology after the submit. Like, well, we know you did this, we're working on it, but it may be that in the next few minutes or seconds that the content either disappears or it may be a bit inconsistent for a while. But that's typically an EDA side effect. All right. So that was actually the demo. Like all good but non-interesting demos, it just worked. Now to recap, I don't know how much time we have, a little bit. So the cloud on its own has some very, very interesting propositions. It can save you money, a lot of money if you use it right. But it also has some challenges. Notable challenges are you have to expect data latency because of the replication. Some nodes inside of your architecture, especially if you have like 100 nodes, may see different data at one single point in time. Eventually, that will be okay as well, right? A few seconds later, the data will probably be there. But there is a possibility that it will act on stale data. You have to take it into account. You have to program it. You have to include state machines inside of your services or event consumers. You have to implement risk mitigation logic to check the boundaries. There's no straight cut answer. You have to have some kind of percentage-wise calculation that something can either happen or not. We also lack distributed transactions. EDA usually doesn't rely on distributed transactions by including all information inside of the event, storing the event in a queue for short or long period of time, and then processing it. Because all of the information is inside of the event, or either local to the event consumer, it should be able to deal with it. And thirdly, it's a global system. Instances will go down during office hours or during business hours. These instances will come up whenever the upgrade or patch or whatever is done. And it should simply be able to continue processing events from the queue. Okay. So that's why an EDA seems interesting to me as an architectural pattern for the cloud.